Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Family Broadcasting Corporation, in association with the Studio DNA Podcast Network, presents What Else with Corey Mann, an interview podcast with your favorite artists. Here's your host, Corey Mann.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy and I need no sympathy, 'cause I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low.
Singer, songwriter, husband, performer, rock star, Mark Martel.
It's a lot of things. How does one person do all those things in one lifetime?
Did I leave anything out?
Former sketch artist, but I have not kept my skills, neither did I ever get my skills as high as yours, so maybe we'll leave that one out.
Well, first, thank you, but I love that you used to put pencil to paper. That's exciting. What did you enjoy drawing?
Oh, people. Not so much cartoons, more realism. One of the earliest drawings that I still have is of George Michael in his Faith days, just wearing the leather jacket and the jeans and the crazy perfect coif and the aviator glasses and the acoustic guitar. So I drew that as a kid, and then I first started drawing Superman, and I can draw his crest in with my eyes closed. It's like the thing I go to, that and Garfield. So I guess I do a little bit of cartooning, but and then in high school I started drawing out of Sports Illustrated, like basketball players going up for, you know, dunks and layups and stuff. And then I got into the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, and then it was over.
You and I have a lot in common. Garfield was my go-to as well.
Yeah.
Loved me some Garfield. Loved me some like original Popeye. But uh-huh. I can't do the lifelike sketchy sketch. So good for you.
Oh well, you know, it's not like I ever got to a point where I was fooling anybody as far as the realism goes. But yeah, I do miss it. I used to do that a lot.
We have attempted to do this conversation for quite a while, so I am going to try my best to walk the balance of not geeking out, because I am a fan. I'm just going to put that out there. I am a fan of your work.
I love it. I'm ready to dive in.
I would love to talk about Canada and your upbringing. I've heard little bits and pieces, but I know nothing about Montreal. I know nothing about Canada. So paint me a picture.
You know, like when I moved down to the States in 2001 with Down Here, you know, we noticed that the differences from our upbringing were kind of subtle. It was more like seeing different things in the grocery store aisles that you weren't quite used to seeing, or different sizes of things. But growing up in Quebec, I guess, is a little different than the rest of Canada. The other guys in the band were from other parts of Canada. And Quebec, as probably most people know, is a French-speaking province. It's actually primarily French, and English is the second language. And so I grew up totally bilingual. I grew up going to church. My dad's a pastor, French church. A lot of my friends were French. I went to French immersion elementary school. So that's like French school for English kids. At home, we spoke English. So a lot about language, and which is kind of the way it is in Quebec. Like you're often reminded about language, because Quebecers are so intent on retaining their culture, because they're in a part of the world that is pretty much exclusively English. They have to be really protective about their language and their culture. Whereas in France, France has been around for so long, and that sort of French has kind of gotten itself into the culture so completely that they're not really afraid of losing that. They'll even like use English words all over the place, whereas in Quebec, they will always use, a lot of people will always use the proper French word for something, even though there's an easier word in English. So yeah, so I kind of grew up with being able to go between two very, I get pretty different cultures. And my side of the family that we got to see a lot was my dad's side, which is French. And my mom came from an English part of in Ontario, in Southern Ontario, where it's all English. But I didn't get to see that part of the family very much. So yeah, I kind of grew up in a pretty bilingual culture. I didn't know anyone who was a professional musician. I remember this one guy who would come through, he'd do the rounds on the local French churches. He was a musician and he had recordings. His name was Richard Loder. And he would sing in both English and French. He was the only person that I ever knew growing up, even into my teens, who even had studio experience, although I didn't really, I still didn't imagine that that might be a path I might take. I was far too pragmatic as a kid. I was super shy, although music definitely was my first love. And somehow I was able to kind of nurture that. My mom is a great musician. She's the piano player at my dad's church. So I always had a stage whenever I wanted it, even when I didn't want it. So yeah, I mean, Quebec is you know, that not that much different than what we know down here in the States, but also a lot different in a lot of ways. Grew up with lots of hockey around me, but never really took part because, well, one, it was too expensive and for a pastor's salary, and especially with three kids. And somehow they always practiced on the weekends, especially on Sunday mornings. So that was not even ever an option for me. I did grow up playing a lot of sports. I was really athletic as a kid, baseball, basketball, a little bit of football, even some soccer until I had a traumatic experience with soccer. I think it was my first time playing quote unquote organized soccer. My mom signed me up for this like pickup league. It wasn't like anything serious, but I guess this guy in town wanted to organize something for the kids that maybe didn't have time or the finances, whatever, for the official leagues. I think I was like 8 years old or something like that. And so I show up for this this soccer field, and there's all these kids, and there's varying ages. I'd say like the age range was about 5 years, like maybe I was in the middle. So they put me in goal. This is how much I know about soccer. And I let in 2 goals because I don't know what I'm doing. I've never played real soccer before. And this older kid in the team after my second goal, and everyone's got their backs turned because they're walking back towards midfield. This kid walks up to me. I don't know him from Adam. Punches me in the stomach and just lays me flat on the ground. And it's the only time in my life I've ever been punched and ever been in what you might consider a fight. So I didn't, needless to say, I never showed up again for soccer.
Now, when you see a soccer ball, do you think of the punch?
Every single time.
When you would call home, or when you call home now, do you speak French with your parents or is it just English?
Always English. And if we speak French at all, it's kind of like our jokey voice. The thing I love about French is that it has like Canadian French, you have to know, is almost nothing like Parisian French. And it's almost like you're comparing hillbilly English to the Queen's English. Not that bad, but kind of you get the idea. And there's just certain words that we use that only make sense to us. And if I was going to translate, if I decided to translate it for you, it wouldn't help. It wouldn't, like, it's one of those things you have to grow up and it's like in your bones and you kind of feel it. And maybe there's stuff that you grew up with that only makes sense to you and you wish that everyone else got the joke, but it's just like, that's the way it is.
Does French come out at all? I'm guessing maybe in your worldly travels as a musician, but I mean, day to day, not really.
I do get to play in Quebec like maybe once a year. There's this one great venue in Quebec City, beautiful old venue right in the really touristy part of Quebec City. And We're supposed to do a residency there in August this year of 10 shows. Beautiful place. And I do the entire show pretty much in French, which is a little intimidating for me because I haven't been speaking French on a regular basis for 20 years. And tell you what, even though I grew up speaking both languages simultaneously, you don't use a language, you lose it. It's tough. I do all right, though. I get by. But it just takes me a week to get back into it.
Do you remember anything Dad said? Like, do you remember any specific stuff? Or
like at church from the pulpit?
Because you were around it so much, it's just a part of your DNA. And do you remember stuff that he said?
He's currently getting familiarized with how to broadcast his sermons. And so I've actually been watching him in the mornings because he's doing like a short sermon every morning, like a 20-minute sermon from his Facebook Live. And it's, you know, for anyone from his church who's cooped up to check out. And so I've actually been just this week getting reacquainted with his preaching style. And I always found him, as far as his style, he was very intense. And as for me as a kid listening, you know, in the audience, it seemed very, I don't want to use the word intimidating, but he was very fiery and he would emphasize words a lot, you know? And, but it's funny that was his style, but he would always he'd always bring it back to grace and to Jesus. And, you know, he's very, I don't know. That was his main thing. I'm trying to think of anything in particular, like a specific quote. I don't think I'd be able to think of that. But
does he still preach the way he did that you remember growing up, or has he evolved and changed?
And I think a lot of it was my childhood insecurities. You know, just being I was a really shy kid and easily intimidated for some reason. I don't know why. I mean, he still has that style of really emphasizing words. You know, he's really got a point to get across. And Quebec, it probably comes down a lot to the fact that Quebec is the least churched area of North America, I think. I think years ago, the statistic was less than half of 1% of the population is evangelical Christian. And I'm sure that has gone down since. I think it just kind of poured out of him like, you know, I'm one of the few guys who's doing this, who's chosen to do this with his life. You know, I can't blame him for feeling, you know, pretty fiery about that.
How did you consume music growing up? I was a kid in the bedroom with the Jambox,
yeah,
or the AM and FM radio, my finger on the pause button with my cassette, and
same,
hoping that you know, I could get a twofer of you know, whatever song. But how did you consume?
George Michael, One More Try. So that is the earliest memory I have of literally what you just described, finger on the pause button, waiting for it to come because I knew it was coming sometime, had to come sometime in the half hour. It was such a huge song. I really loved soft pop rock. And I remember getting it, and I remember, like, you know how you don't necessarily get the very beginning of the song because it's on radio and the guy's talking over it or whatever, the transition music. And so
I am that guy. You,
foiled again. But yeah, I remember for probably years, that was the version of the song that I had in my head. I never caught the very first opening chords of the song. Yeah. And so that's how I consumed music. It was really, I have lots of memories just in my bedroom waiting for the next song to add to my mixtape. meant a little something different back then, I guess. Yeah, that's how I consumed it. My first record that I sort of took ownership was that I really consumed was this guy down the street. His name was Mike Roundtree, and he gave my mom this compilation of his favorite Keith Green songs. And I had never heard of Keith Green. My mom had never heard of Keith Green. This was like not too long after Keith would have passed away, like in the early 80s. And so my mom started listening to this guy, and I was like, oh man, this guy's like, it's fun music. It's piano driven. I love the piano. I'd already started piano lessons. And that was the first guy that I really went hard in the paint with as far as his music. But the first album I ever bought with my own money was Milli Vanilli's one record.
I remember that day like it was yesterday.
Do you?
Because I played, well, I'm a handful of years older than you, but I played those songs when they were original hits.
That is an incredible album. I don't care what people say about the whole schapazzle that went down with them, but that is an amazing pop record.
I was in Merrillville, Indiana at a big mall and bought it and played it to death. Blame It on the Rain, Girl, I'm Gonna Miss You, ugh. Girl, You Know It's True, ugh. All or Nothing.
Oh, taking me back. I would go for walks late at night with my Walkman and just crank Blame It on the Rain, all that stuff over and over again. I wore that record out and then seamlessly transitioned into New Kids on the Block.
This conversation's over. You know, I was watching a video of you online playing guitar, and I kind of forgot that, man, you're really good at the instruments. When did you pick up the guitar? When did the piano lessons start? My guitar teacher's like, what do you want to learn, little man?
Yeah, that's funny. I always think it's hilarious when a teacher asks his student what they want to learn. Because that was not my experience at all. It was like, well, I've got this old book of really, really old songs that I'm going to show you how to play. And my piano teacher had really fat fingers. He was an incredible player, and he was a really nice guy. I don't know why I felt like I had to throw that in. So my experience of learning the piano, I started like at about age 6. And for some reason, I always feel like Jason Germain, my co-lead singer from down here, always had me beat there because he started when he was 5. I started when I was 6. Like, he got me. But anyway, I started piano lessons probably around, 6 years old. And a few years after I started piano, my mom signed me up for real piano lessons, like paid piano lessons down. Like I had to skateboard there to get there fast enough or else it was like a really long walk. And this guy would teach me the piano and I would learn the classics, Beethoven, whatever. And I would do a recital, you know, 3-4 times a year, whatever it was. And I really loved the piano because my mom was a pianist, obviously. And my earliest musical memories were of me and my younger brother and sister being put to sleep every night with my mom playing the piano. She would play, a favorite was Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. And I would try to play that song and I knew I couldn't make it sound like my mom's because, and she later told me, well, the reason why it sounds fuller with me is because I have bigger hands and I can reach an octave and it makes it. And I was like, oh man, I can't wait till my hands are big enough to play an octave and all that. I really enjoyed piano lessons. I didn't love practicing. Obviously, like most kids in piano lessons, I had to be forced to practice, but I swallowed it pretty good and kept it up pretty well without too much having to be forced to, just because I loved it naturally. And then when I turned 14, I was naturally feeling like I wanted to write my own music. And I knew that the guitar was going to make it easier in that domain. And so I picked up the guitar. I'd been playing my mom's gut string, and they have really wide necks. And well, I guess I was a pretty big kid, so it didn't really matter. But I remember a few doors down, this old man had passed away, and they were holding an estate sale, and my dad went down there and they bought me this kind of busted acoustic guitar. It had black tar on the butt of the guitar to repair this huge crack on it. But that was my first acoustic guitar, bought for, I think, actually 40 Canadian, so it's more like 20 bucks American. And that thing hurt to play. And not just because it was my first acoustic guitar, but I think the action wasn't great on it and like made my fingers really hurt. But it was a good entry into acoustic guitar, and that's when I started writing my own music, and really loved both instruments now.
Man, we have so much in common. My first guitar was from Sears.
Yeah, yeah.
The nylon strings were about a good inch off the neck.
Uh-huh.
And pressing them down, oh my gosh. Oh,
it hurts.
I can see the Christmas morning picture of me holding this guitar thinking, this is the greatest thing I'll ever get. And my dad going, well, it was only about 20 bucks because we don't want to fully commit yet.
Oh, okay. How old were you?
Oh, teenager. So probably 12, 13.
Yeah, that's right around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, yeah. Cool.
Who told you you could sing?
I've thought about this question a little bit. Like, people ask me, when did you know you could sing? And I think no one told me that I wasn't good at it, so I kept going at it. I don't know. I think I probably discovered that maybe I had a little bit more gifting in that area in high school. But as a kid, though, I loved to sing. I used to sing all the time. And my parents were really good at nurturing that and seeing my just natural gravitation towards, well, he's a shy kid. He'd rather stay indoors, but at least he's doing something creative and musical. And my mom used to tell me that I was the kid that, well, to this day tells me that I was the kid that would rather stay inside and play the piano than hang out with kids. Now, that paints a pretty black and white picture. It wasn't quite that black and white, but yeah, I definitely, it's even that tendency in me plays out even in this quarantine time where I'm getting so much work done because I get to be at home and just do my own thing as much as I want. So, and that kind of tendency in me, I guess, allowed me to develop my musical skills pretty quickly. And in high school, when I started to really have a desire to perform in front of people, every year we'd have this variety show where kids would just do whatever they wanted on stage. And every year I would look forward to that. And, you know, what's the big song this year? What's the big song I want to showcase to my friends and show them how talented I am? And I remember playing Eric Clapton's Tears in Heaven on my mom's gut string. That's also where I had my first band experience. I got these guys together at school who could play, and we played Guns N' Roses' November Rain, and I was on the piano. I felt like such a rock star.
Yes.
Our guitar player dropped out the day of, and this new kid at school who happened to be this amazing guitar player filled in at the last minute and killed it.
And that's like a 9-minute opus that you're going to have to kill.
Yeah, and he did. I couldn't believe it. I was like, ooh, we're the same, you and me.
So November Rain was a big song at the variety show. Any other songs you remember?
Yep. More Than Words by Extreme.
Of course.
I did that one. How did we perform? I did it with two sisters, the Mazzetta sisters. One, the older sister was playing the piano, and my friend Suzanne was singing the other vocal part. And I can't remember if I think I was also playing guitar on that. So there was that one. I'm trying to think of any other songs. Oh, my goodness. Yes. Another one I performed at the variety show was Michael W. Smith's Too Many Times, which is like a deep track from his very first album. It's this beautiful ballad, and it was right in the time where Michael W. Smith had just released Eye to Eye, and I had consumed that whole record until I was, you know, I couldn't listen to it anymore. And I was like, what else does he have? And it was before Go West, Young Man was released. So I had to go back to the older stuff, and I found his first record, Project. And I found this song, Too Many Times, and for some reason decided to play that in front of a school where like there were no, there was literally no one else in that school who'd ever heard of Michael W. Smith. And so I performed this random song no one's ever heard of. And a week later, and after my performance, I was like, I wonder if I should have played that, even though I got a great, you know, reaction from it, whatever. But as a budding musician, I didn't realize that you're supposed to play, when you get in front of people, you should play stuff that people know. So anyway, I did that. And then a week later, I was on the basketball team and I was having a particularly bad day, missing a lot of shots. And at one point, the whole bench, after I missed a shot, got up on their feet and sang, "Too many times. It made me feel so good that they had, like, this song that they had heard once from one of their classmates performing on stage that had stuck with them. Again, you know, they got the hook. They remembered it, and it made me feel really good.
That whole basketball story needs to be in your movie. It better be in there.
Yeah. Oh, here's another story that if they ever make a movie about me.
And they will.
What a terrible thing to say. It's one of those scenes that I feel like, man, that's like something out of a movie when I think of this time. So when I was, after 10th grade, my dad changed to a different church and we had to move to a different town, actually in Ontario, outside of Quebec. And so I was in this new high school. We had this one day where I think the weather was really bad and some of the teachers couldn't even make it because the storm, it was like a huge blizzard. And so we had all these periods that the classes were canceled. So the whole day, the 11th and 12th graders were like in the cafeteria, just hanging out, studying, whatever. And they were playing Aerosmith's Big Ones on the speakers, which is
a high quality greatest hits package.
Absolutely. One of the best. And I knew that record so well and for some reason thought it would be totally okay for me to sing out loud to the whole thing in the cafeteria that was full of my, you know, peers. Tell me now, it's untrue. What did her daddy do? He just a little bitty baby. The man has got the beans. And then the next day I come back to the cafeteria and I happened to be sitting on the table right next to the one I'd been sitting at the day before when I was singing the whole Aerosmith record. And someone had scratched in blue pen very angrily, "Will Mark Martell ever shut up?" And scene.
Everybody says a Christian band. Let's call it for this interview a faith-based band. You come to America, down here. I've been in radio, Mark, since I was 18 years old. And then I got into CCM radio in 2009. And I remember the record label sending me Down Here songs. And I loved them. And I honestly sat and thought about this. I remember hearing your voice going, this guy's actually too good for this genre.
Shut up.
I remember hearing the other lead singer, which I thought was fascinating, two lead singers.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember hearing your voice going, what is this guy doing in our pool?
Wow. That is one of the bigger compliments I think I've ever received. But wow, that's a really nice thing to say. Thank you.
I love some of them deep cuts it down here.
Mm-hmm. Like?
Living a Dream.
Yeah, all right. So you got into our stuff in 2009, you said.
Yeah. Well, this is not what I imagined, but this is real. Life in the trenches and we are living a dream. Every day comes with the promise that
yeah, that was definitely like on the latter half of our career.
I remember there being a song where I thought, if I ever get to talk to you, I'm going to go, how big of an influence are the Beatles on your band?
Oh, really? Interesting, because very little, honestly. unless it's a song that our bass player Glenn had something to do with. He was more of the cool music guy.
This is too creative for our genre. This is too good. And then in 2011, you make this video.
Mark Martel, Somebody to Love Audition. Here we go.
Each morning I get up, I tie a little. Can barely stand on my feet.
Take a look
in the mirror and cry. Lord, what you doing to me?
And now every time I hear that Queen song, I have to stick in, and this is the guitar solo. Yeah. That's your fault.
This is the guitar solo, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I honestly think about that about half the time that I'm performing it. So I don't think I've ever yelled it out actually from stage, except for maybe once when I was goofing off. But no, I've refrained from actually putting that into the show.
Did you have Queen on your radar? Because from the point we've started talking to right here, you have not mentioned Queen in your childhood soundtrack at all.
Which is completely appropriate. I did not grow up knowing they even existed. My first ever hearing one of their songs was in Wayne's World.
This is my best friend, Garth Algar.
Hi.
I think we'll go with a little Bohemian Rhapsody, gentlemen.
Good call.
Even then, I don't even know if I went, like, I remember hearing Bohemian Rhapsody in that scene and going, what is this? This is crazy awesome, like so creative and classical yet rock. And I didn't know what to make of it, except, and also like the singer, sometimes I couldn't tell, is that a girl or is that a guy? It made me feel cool because I knew I could sound like a girl, but I really shied away from that side of my voice because I didn't know if that was okay. Having a higher voice and doing really softer tones, even though I was a big George Michael fan, you know, with his softer voice, there was a little less of a feminine thing in his voice, where Freddie could do this really light, airy thing and almost like he was trying to sound like a girl. And I thought, wow, here's a guy who seems to have been in a very successful band whose name I don't know, doing this thing with gusto and not caring. And anyway, so that was the first time I'd ever heard Queen. And I think I discovered not too long later that the band was called Queen. And my first reaction as a pastor's kid was like, whoa, that's kind of weird to name your band Queen. What does that mean? So, yeah, no, they were not a part of our household at all. I don't even think my parents were aware of them. I didn't really get into Queen until after Down Here formed. We officially formed in 99 and then moved to the States in 2001 and picked up a new bass player. And Glenn, who is the only guy in Down Here who grew up listening to, I don't know, I can't think of a better word than cool music. Like, you know, the first record he ever owned was Queen Hot Space, and he loved the Chili Peppers and all this stuff that only the cooler kids at school who were like finding their own music and didn't want to listen to the mainstream stuff. That was Glenn. And so he's the guy that really introduced me to Queen. And he knew that I had this tendency in me to form my voice to other singers. And maybe that's a whole conversation for the therapy couch. Why do I love imitating other singers? Like George Michael, I love doing an impression of him. I love doing an impression of Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day, Jeff Buckley, Bono. Gosh, who else? Oh, of course, Eddie Vedder. Eddie Vedder. So this is kind of the turning point where I got into Queen. If you listen to early Down Here records, especially the first two, you can hear a guy who's trying to shake his Eddie Vedder influences, sort of come into a realization that doesn't really fit his style of music, nor his voice, because I don't have the depth in my voice that Eddie Vedder has. And obviously everyone was trying to do that voice back then.
Oh, seasons pass, they come and go.
Glenn was very acutely aware of that fact, and he knew that he was one of the few guys who knew what my voice just sounded like naturally. And he's like, you know, when you sing just naturally, when you're not trying to imitate anyone, you sound like pretty much identical to this Freddie Mercury guy. And you should listen to their music just to get some pointers on how to develop your voice. You develop your own voice. So, you know, when I started to let go of the Eddie Vedder thing, that's when I started immediately getting comparisons to this Freddie Mercury guy who I'm fairly well acquainted with these days.
When did you decide, okay, it's time to go to school on this Queen thing? Because it might end up being a thing. Was it when you got the audition and it started to really roll along? Like,
no, I took a deep dive in the early 2000s after I got, after Glenn convinced me I need to really dive into Queen. I got the Greatest Hits record and finally put it together. Like, okay, Queen is the Bohemian Rhapsody band. So I listened to Bohemian Rhapsody over and over and over again. And I actually have this recording still that very few people own of me re-recording Bohemian Rhapsody in its entirety in 2003, 2004. Just, it was like a musical education for me. It's funny. I actually just listened to it again a few days ago, and I hadn't listened to it in a couple years. Just hearing how far I've come since then as a musician and just in what I now hear in Bohemian Rhapsody as opposed to what I used to hear when I first was discovering it. So, you know, I played all the instruments like in my home studio. It's my bedroom. My bedroom studio back then, you know, played the drums on the keyboards and, you know, borrowed someone's bass guitar and did all the choir parts by myself. So that's when I really dove into Queen. And I can't say like I became a Queen super fan or anything like that, but they definitely became part of my influences. Which you can probably hear in, what's our song? My Last Amen. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that one. That was on Ending is Beginning. And that would probably be the song where Down Here kind of showed their Queen influences the most. But yeah, they became one of my, I guess you could say top 10 acts. But, you know, I never thought that my path was going to cross with their music any more than that. She keeps them away, Shonda. She says, just like Marie Antoinette, a building, a remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy at any time of invitation. You know them. You're on a first-name basis with them. You know, Roger Taylor's putting together a tribute band. I kind of lose a bit of the story here. Did he actually play in this band with you? No. They actually, people get confused here because we made our debut on American Idol in 2012. And they played on stage with us. So yes, I have performed with Queen technically, but no, he was not in the band. He was only overseeing, and he was very, very hands-on. I mean, he was there for the entire month that we were rehearsing before our first tour. So we rehearsed in Montreal and Toronto, and he was there every single day while we were like learning our parts, and he was giving his input, and this should sound this way. Like, the drums should really have this weight to them, you know? And he's talking to the front of house mixing engineer, telling him how the drums should sound in the house. And, you know, and I'm doing interviews with Roger because there's like this viral buzz around me. So every time Roger would do an interview, you know, usually I'd be there with him, and the radio people were asking about, you know, this newcomer who's coming along and making waves with the sound of his voice. And it was a really, really interestingly and bizarre time.
Who was the authority to assist you in, you know, getting it? Because you do nail it. Let's just put that out there. You nail it. Is he the guy that you would go, he really helped me dial it in? Or is there somebody else?
Roger?
Yeah.
No, he didn't really give me any pointers, honestly. And I think he did that on purpose because he didn't want the band to be a traditional tribute act. And he really was very leery of using the word tribute. Unfortunately, there really isn't a better word to describe the band. I mean, it is a tribute, you know, it's just not the kind where you dress up and pretend like you're the actual person. But, he really encouraged us to be ourselves on stage and to not do the what he would consider the very corny thing of acting. You know, we're musicians, we're not actors. We're just giving the best reproduction of the music was his vision behind the band. As far as the vocal resemblances, you know, if I hear someone singing a song that was originally recorded with a British accent, singing it with an American accent, that makes my soul kind of shrivel up a little bit. So when I do Queen, I do put on Freddie's accent, and that's basically what gets me there, you know? Aside from, I don't know, like that, it's kind of a weird thing in my brain. Like, okay, I'm myself on stage and I naturally sound like him. And I do this thing where I kind of change the way I enunciate the words, and it's like I'm imitating him, but it's not, I'm not really. It's in a way I am, but not. It's a strange thing.
Do you take care of your voice differently now than you did previously?
This is a very apropos question. Actually, just got off a 2-month tour in Germany and got really sick about a week and a half into the tour. I showed very much the symptoms of a now well-known virus. Was never diagnosed, but we'll leave it at that. Got a throat infection. Lungs were full of gunk. I actually lost my voice to the point where I had to postpone 8 shows. So that has never happened to me in my entire life. I've been doing this for 20 years. Down here, never canceled a show. I've always been able to sing through a show, even if I had the flu. This time, it just wasn't happening. I showed up to sound check one day, and I feel bad for everyone who is in the room, like the crew and the band, because I sounded absolutely horrible. And I was like, what do we do? This is new territory for me. And so luckily my manager, Josh, was on the road with me and helped me, you know, navigate these really, really tough decisions. It felt horrible. And we had to cancel the show that night at Doors, which was one of the worst feelings I've ever experienced. I took a week off, 5 days to recover, got my voice back, was ready to go again. First show back, like I said, you know, symptoms, I felt great. And then went back to work. And then halfway through the show, my voice started going down again. And I was like, what is going on? I felt perfect at the beginning of the show. And then halfway through, I had this first time in my life experience of my voice deteriorating halfway through a show. I walk off stage and I am like so depressed. And Josh was like, whoa, I don't know. I've never seen you like this before. And the next day we had another show and we were in Austria. I was in the same place that I was a week before where I couldn't sing at soundcheck. And we made the decision that we couldn't postpone another show at Doors. That would just like really damage our reputation. And that's not something we were interested in. And so I did the show. I like crawled through the show vocally speaking. And I'm pretty sure most of the audience could tell. Usually the audience can't tell when you're having a bad vocal night, but I'm pretty sure they could tell that night. But before the show, I got on the phone, a FaceTime call with a friend of mine here in town in Nashville, who's a really great vocal coach, Sophie Shear. She walked me through a vocal warm-up. Now, my voice was in such bad shape that day that it probably helped a little bit, but I still sucked. But ever since that experience, now before every show, I've got this brand new vocal regimen that I take like 2 full hours to properly warm up, which I never did that before. I'd warm up for like 5 minutes, just kind of yelling, basically, which is the exact opposite of what you're supposed to do to take care of your voice. And I'd walk on stage with having just yelled a few lines and basically use the first 2 songs of the show to warm up my voice. This is what I was accustomed to. But now, since having that brand new experience in January, now I take way better care of my voice. I've always taken good care of my voice. Like, sleep has always been the most important thing to me, staying really hydrated. Now I stay even more hydrated and try to do even better sleep, and I do a really intense vocal warm-up, and it has really changed the way that I feel on stage. Like, I can walk on stage now after that warm-up and feel like 100% ready to hit the whole show.
Bohemian Rhapsody, phenomenal movie. Congratulations. now you get to have this great conversation of, hey, I helped a guy win an Oscar. I mean, literally, which I think is awesome. Well done with that. I've seen you perform twice, the Queen show.
Mm-hmm.
It took me the first song to really go, my gosh, he is nailing it. And then from after Tie Your Mother Down, I enjoyed it. And then the next time I saw you about a year later, I was watching the crowd from the perspective, I think, of what you see. There has to be that moment of, all right, let's see if this guy's got what it, I mean, mm-hmm. let's see for ourselves.
Yeah.
Do you see that from the stage of when people finally go, all right, we're in, and then they can enjoy the rest of the evening? Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I count myself so lucky to be able to give people that experience. I do see that from stage when the lights aren't blinding me. Yeah, it's such a great feeling to see the tears in people's eyes. I see a lot of like mouths agape. I try not to let it go to my head, but at the same time, it's like, wow, like I get to give people this experience that probably a lot of them never thought that they'd ever get. I hold that with open hands, and I'm really thankful to be able to do that. And just realize that I've been given this platform for some reason, this thing I would have never guessed would ever be a part of my musical journey, but I love doing it. It is the main thing that keeps me doing this, even though I'm performing someone else's music. It's really what gets me up on stage to do someone else's music instead of my own, and just knowing that, man, people walk away convinced. You know, it's just an amazing feeling. I don't know what else to say about that.
It was the great prophet John Bon Jovi that said, mm-hmm. I've seen a million faces, and I've rocked them all. Have you enjoyed seeing the world?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a privilege to be able to see the world that we're all standing on. I mean, it really shrinks it for me. And just knowing that there are people directly on the opposite side of this globe that are doing a lot of the same things that we're doing and enjoying the same things and getting to see those cultures, some more interesting than others. You know, I don't know. It's I love getting this, the richest experience that I can, even though it's not something that, because I'm a homebody, honestly. I love being at home. I'm just going to put that out there into the universe. I don't have a wandering spirit, but this job that I have takes me all over the world, and I also love that. It's because I know it's just opening my eyes to something bigger than just my home community. And you know, you gotta count that as something so worthwhile.
If you do a deep dive on some of your rock music videos, there's one of you doing a cover song, and there's a giant map of the world behind you, and uh-huh. there's a bookcase. And I think I'm seeing Hardy Boys books.
You are.
I loved those books growing up.
Here's the thing. They're my wife's. She owns pretty much the whole Hardy Boys collection and Nancy Drew. I did read like two or three of the books when I was a kid. So you're definitely a huge, huger fan than me.
What makes a great baseball hat? Because my friend, you can rock it well.
Well, it has to fit right, and I'm into the flat bills. I try not to keep the bill flat. I have erroneously on a few occasions worn a flat bill, but I try to curve it a little bit, give it some shape. What makes it great, though? I don't know. I mean, I like both the snapbacks and the fitted ones. I tend to go towards the snapbacks most of the time because I can adjust them if my head's hurting. And I kind of only stick to the baseball ones because I think that's where they originally came from. And it feels weird for me to wear a hockey team on a baseball type hat.
I was listening to Thunderbolt and Lightning yesterday to prep. I'm dying to know, production nerd question, how many vocal layers on Bohemian Rhapsody?
Ooh, man, I think there are seven parts, and every part has, gosh, I don't want to get this wrong, but I probably am. But if I had to take a guess, it's 7 times 5, 35, at least 35 layers. I actually did all that, the middle part, by myself at home, and I actually already had it prepared because I made that middle section for our live performances because, you know, we didn't want to run into any legality issues with Queen and just using their recording. So in Bohemian Rhapsody, we used that recording and I already had it prepared when I got into the studio with Ben. Ben did the rest of the song for sure. But yeah, that middle part was all me.
I wonder if you would ever consider a George Michael EP.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I've sort of daydreamed about that a little bit. That could be really fun. I mean, I could definitely fill an EP with some of my favorite songs of his. I'm actually releasing my next one take video is a George Michael performance. So funny you should say that.
Please tell me it's Why Can't You Do It? Why Can't You Set Your Monkey Free?
That is one of the more bizarres?
But it's a jam.
Yeah.
It is a jam.
Why can't you do it?
Why can't you set your monkey free?
I just wrote a whole, like, 4 or 5 paragraphs about my experience growing up with George's music for the release of this video. So I hope people enjoy that.
What's next? I Hear Through the Grapevine live album.
Yes. We've got a recorded performance live from Auckland, New Zealand from our tour last year, and it'll be out. That's coming real soon.
Mark, thank you so much. It's a privilege and a pleasure. I hope we can become friends.
I think we already are, man. I think we're there.
Are we there?
We're there. Yeah, we're done.
Woo!
I see a little silhouette of a man.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the bandango?
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, 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 Galileo,
Galileo. I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family. Spare his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah, no, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah,
we will not let you go.
Let me go!
We will not let you go.
Let me go!
We will not let you go.
Let me go!
No, 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 no.
Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia.
Mamma mia, let me go.
Beelzebub has the devil put aside for me.
Thanks for listening to What Else with Corey Mann. Production elements and voiceovers by audiblegenesis.com. Engineered by Phil Souza. Executive producer is Danae Hughes. In partnership with the Studio DNA Podcast Network. Interested in your own podcast? Contact Danae@studiodna.media. What Else? Previous podcast episodes and interviews available on iTunes, Spotify, and Spreaker.com. Hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Leave a review too. Find complete podcast tools and production at audiblegenesis.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.